Welcome to Touchy Subject. This is going to be a fun panel.
I don't think you should laugh creepily like that.
So I figured we all have an opportunity to introduce ourselves and tell you a little bit about what we do. So we'll start over at the end with Corey Silverberg.
Oh, that's it? Yeah, that's the whole thing.
Well, you talk. Tell the world what you do.
So, the world. Hi, everyone. My name's Corey. I used to talking and holding a mic. By training, I'm a sex educator, and I work in Canadian. I'm from here, although sadly I live in the United States now. The country itself, I'm rather than this country. So I work as a sex educator, and for the past, 7 or 8 years, I've been working on a series of kids' books about sex and gender. And I worked with Fiona Smith, who's a Canadian illustrator, and so the first one was called Love Makes a Baby, and it had how long do you want me to talk?
A minute or so.
Oh, okay, great. So I work a lot with families, and I work a lot with educators, and I train them. And my interest is really in what I say is that I'm sort of creating queer sex education, which doesn't mean it's just sex education for people who call themselves queer like me, but rather it's completely reinventing the way we talk about sex and gender, because the way we do it in traditional sex education actually isn't that good, or it leaves a lot of kids out. So my interest is in how we can do things that isn't just for the kids that we're never talking about, but includes them and centers their experience. Yeah. And it's for very young kids. So my first book was 4 to 6 year olds, second book was 7 to 10, and the next one I'm working on is sort of puberty age.
Who here has heard of Sex is a Funny Word? Oh, excellent. Good. It's such a great book.
Thank you.
Matthew Holm.
Hello. Hi. I'm Matt Holm. I'm an author illustrator. I am probably best known for the Baby Mouse series and the Squish series. I do most of my work with my sister Jenny. And before our latest book, Sunny Side Up, we were specifically never doing anything that was touchy subjects whatsoever. I mean, Baby Mouse is completely harmless, and we worked hard. We actually worked pretty hard to make sure that there wasn't anything that could be objectionable in it, because it came out at a time when there weren't many kids' comics, and the things that were available for libraries was manga, and people were so terrified of it because they didn't know what they were going to find on page 200 of it. You know, suddenly, oh, there's someone naked. You know, you weren't expecting that. So we wanted to make sure that any parent, any kid could pick it up and there wouldn't be a problem. But with Sunny Side Up, we're actually drawing real people in it. I mean, well, fictionalized versions, but they're actual human beings, not mice or microbes. And so we are dealing with, some harder subjects about behavioral problems, drug problems, smoking, which, you know, used to just be a thing, and now it's a problem, you know, other than it used to kill everybody. It's just, even depicting it in comics, or in kids' books in general, can be a touchy subject in and of itself.
And to my right is Fatima Farage.
That's me. Am I on? I'm not on. Turn me on. Turn me on.
More of those left.
I'm a junior school teacher librarian. I work at Grayson Hall, but I worked in the public school board before that as a classroom teacher, and then I was a middle school teacher librarian. My history with graphic novels, comics, I was one of the very first people to read the graphic novels and promote them to be used in the classroom with teachers and take away the scariness of having these comics or graphic novels in the classroom. I remember reading Bone and being like, and that was kind of, oh, what are we doing with this now? And now it's just on the shelves and it's not there. So anyway, I guess that's me. I'm a teacher librarian. I work with JK grade 6 and all girls now, so touchy subjects come up quite a bit.
And my name's Scott Robbins. I'm a children's services specialist with the Toronto Public Library at the Don Mills branch. And I'm also the co-author of a book called The Parent's Guide to the Best Kids Comics. And when the publisher approached myself and my co-writer, Sinead Wildsmith, to write the book, one of the things that she insisted that we include was a section that we called Heads Up, which it was basically looking at every graphic novel and sort of looking at every single possible thing that could offend someone in the graphic novel. So hopefully it's helpful for parents. I think that when parents have more information, they're better empowered to make, you know, choices for their children. But I think it's also important that kids make their own choices as well when it comes to the reading. So the way that this panel is going to go is we're going to start off with Corey and Matt are going to, we're going to look at their specific works, and they're going to talk a bit about the sort of tips and tricks that they use to soften or make acceptable their sort of areas where they show touchy subjects in their work. So I think we're going to be starting off with Corey. So we'll just go to the next slide. And this is more a roundtable discussion, so it's kind of loose and fancy free, which is the way that I like it. So all of us might jump in and make a comment on your work as well. So let's start here. So here we have sex is a funny word.
So maybe I'll just say very quickly. So the book, the thing about age groups is a real pet peeve of mine. A lot of my work in my life is actually spent in the disability community. And the idea that you can say that something's for 7 to 10 year olds just doesn't work, right? 7 to 10 year olds, it means almost nothing. So I write to experience. So what was missing, there were no books for kids. All the books for kids about sexuality, and there's now a few books about gender, but there used to be none. They all basically tell you where babies come from and talk about puberty. As if kids don't have bodies between the age of 4 when they sometimes start asking about where babies come from, and whatever, 10, 11, 12, when puberty hits. So this book was specifically written for kids that are not only nowhere near, they're nowhere near puberty and their friends aren't going through puberty, because in my experience as an educator, when you tell a kid your hair is going to start to grow down there, and it's a kid who is nowhere near puberty and none of their friends are going through puberty, it makes no sense. It doesn't actually serve any function. The kid thinks you're weird and you're talking about some alien experience. Anyway, so this is specifically for kids pre-puberty.
Just give me a little hand signal or something if you want me to change this
slide. So one of the biggest challenges was gender. This is an illustration. And let me just say this. The illustrations do all the work. Right, like it took 2 years to write it, and part of that is because it's a very collaborative process, so I essentially wrote the book with about 100 other parents and kids. So the writing's not easy. Having said that, I realized that gender is not a concrete concept. It's very hard for most of us to understand, and even harder for young kids who don't have any, usually don't have a lot of critical thinking skills yet. So this is just, we were like, how are we going to do the idea that, like, the question is, what is gender, right? And I actually am someone who spent years thinking about this, and I don't have an answer, and I don't actually like people who think they do have an answer. Well, I like the people, I don't like the answer. but what I can say is gender is something that's experienced, that we can say something, gender is something that's experienced inside of yourself, and that's expressed outside of yourself, and that's the only generality I can make. I can't say where it is, the brain, it's in the body, I don't know, and I don't actually have much skin in that game. And Fiona did this illustration, which is what we're seeing is younger kids and perhaps their older selves with a focus on gender representation. So that's just, you know, the words are important, but part of me actually honestly wants to just go, the words are just blah, blah, blah. Because kids see this. And kids that are really kind of gender normative and like, you know, born with a penis and call a boy and feel like a boy, they don't see this and go, huh? They see this and they'll see some of themselves and they'll see some of their friends. And kids that are gender nonconforming or gender queer or for whom this isn't so easy see a lot and get so excited. And I start talking about this and I start actually wanting to cry a little bit because I was a gender nonconforming kid and you never see anything like this. And the last character is the last person, is one of the main characters whose name is Zai, who's gender nonconforming.
Was there a specific conscious choice to use the sort of multicolored characters to kind of not necessarily avoid the whole race?
Yeah, so that's a good question. People write about this all the time. So this is just how Fiona draws. So I never said to Fiona, even with our first book, make them all bright pink and blue because that's Fiona's illustration style. I don't think we avoid race. And we talked about this. Like, these characters are racialized. And we talked about, and in fact, I wrote backstories for each character that included race. But it brings up great conversation because, particularly for the younger book, kids will say, "Why is that person purple?" And they say, "Well, what do you mean?" And they say, "Well, why are black?" And the kids don't actually say that, but it allows you to talk about race and it allows you to talk about that. we're all lots of different colors. Race is complicated. So it's just, it's mostly an artifact of Fiona. I'll say something very quickly about this. So in the middle section, we talk about body parts, and we write about body parts in a way that doesn't gender, that doesn't stick to gender binary. So we don't say girls have boobs and boys have penises. But what's key to this, and this is actually something that I got from a sex educator in Toronto, his name is Karen Chan, is that we don't have what every other book has, which is a picture, a normative picture of one outline of the body. And this is the way Scott mentioned tips. This is my tip around this, is if you want to show diversity, if you don't want to tell kids that this is the right way to do it, just show a lot of things all at once. And they don't have to all be big, and they don't have to all be clear. Right? Some people are like, these aren't scientific. And of course they're not scientific, but actually I don't think that 7 to 10-year-olds need scientific drawings. They're Fiona's drawings. So there's so much we could talk about, right? There's mastectomies, and it's also, it was important for us to have lots of actual bodies. But mostly the thing I'd say here is just show a lot. And that's one way of getting away from the idea that what I did as a kid is I would look at these bodies, and even though, of course, they were always white kids, and I'm a white kid, and the parts that I was born with are pretty normative, I still wouldn't see myself. You know? So anyway, and I find it easier to do here.
Can I just say something? I purchased this book when it came out, and then we have it in our library, and I think even for myself, I think that was my first connection, was the whole idea that you start to say, oh, because I think the book that I remember getting when I was a kid was What's Happening to Me, right?
Yeah.
And so this all of a sudden, I think, opens up the conversation to realizing that not everybody's the same. So.
And I'll show one other quick story, which is that it's a 160-page book. It's all comics, which is, and kids read it in one sitting. This is the story from parents all the time. And then often parents will say, well, what did you remember? And the hilarious thing is, of the 160 pages, it's usually this page on the left, and kids often say, did you know that people can have 3 nipples? This is like their favorite thing. And there's something in this book about sexual abuse and masturbation, and all gender, all these huge things. The kids are really into the fact that you can have 3 nipples. I mean, and not everyone can. This is just an illustration. This was a hard one, so there's a chapter on masturbation. And really, we decided we didn't want hands-down pants for 2 reasons. One is that I don't want to make a book that's sexually explicit for little kids. It's not that I'm very happy for kids to have to masturbate and explore their bodies privately, but it's actually private. So that's a little weird for me. And then the other thing is, of course, all our bodies are different, and not everyone masturbates by putting their hands down their pants. So Fiona was given a very tough challenge of depicting masturbation, and this is how she did it. And I think it's great. You know, it's these lines. It's energy. This is more masturbation. Right. So again, this is the thing, and I guess I'll just say this is why comics are so great, right? Like, I'm not going to say in words, like, what do I say? Masturbation, I say it can feel good. But beyond that, to a 7 to 10 year old, I'm not going to say, like, I think maybe I say tingly, but you're not going to get into it because also, for 2 reasons. One is, again, 7 to 10-year-olds. And 2, I don't even know what to say. I don't know what masturbation feels like for anyone else other than me. I just have to get closer. So, and then Fiona just did that comic. Again, this is Zai. So, and this is late in the book. So this is a character that we know and we like. And that comic does so much of the work for me. I think this is probably the last one. So there is a chapter on sexual abuse, and it was a hard chapter to write for all sorts of reasons. This is actually a 2-page spread that got a little bit cut, and we didn't know what to do. And I worked a lot with professionals, and they all kept saying to make it less scary. So the earlier versions, it was darker, and Fiona and I were responding to our own understanding and connection to the topic. And the professionals were like, if you make it scary, no one's going to read that chapter. So don't make it scary. So what she did was this thing where she just, we talked about what puts kids at risk most is isolation, being alone. So the whole spread is this, it's a park and it's a playground. On the right, we see lots of kids playing and having fun, and on the left, we see a kid that's alone. And even in earlier versions, there were stress lines around his face, and again, professionals were like, could you take those off? Because the kids that are working, I was talking specifically to kids who are working right now with children who are experiencing abuse, and they're like, those stress lines aren't going to help those kids, right? They're not going to make this kid more identifiable, and they're just going to add a layer. So it was tough because Fiona and I didn't want to make it look like the rest of the book, because then that seems to
material in this book only because there's such a huge lack of books about sexual abuse in children's books. There's just so little out there.
And they're always that special book that nobody wants to pull off the shelf.
Yeah.
And just to add on to that, just the text, depending if you're spending time reading the words or just looking at the pictures, there's something in it for it's accessible for everyone to talk to or to understand. So.
And just one last thing, because you brought up race. So we specifically want to make the kid African American, well, yeah. Black, because almost all the books are, it's all white kids,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And of course, just what gets confused, but really, in the mainstream books that are available on Amazon and in bookstores and libraries, it's all white kids. So, and this is just another example. So, this is from our first book, which is where babies come from. And on the left is a picture of vaginal birth, and on the right is a picture of a cesarean birth. And it's just Fiona being great.
Oh,
all right, yeah,
I'm actually going to stand up so I can see. So, Sunny Side Up is semi-autobiographical. It's based on our childhood. A lot of the flavor is very, in terms of setting and time period and everything, is very much derived from our childhood. Some of the characters are compressed or conflated, from real family members, things like that. But the basic upshot is Sunny is a 10-year-old girl, and her older brother is starting to go off the rails with some behavioral problems and some drug abuse. And the whole story centers around the fact that nobody's talking about what's going on. And so, which is really how we wound up doing this as a graphic novel. Jenny originally was going to write this as one of her novels. She's, if you don't know, we do Baby Mouse, but she also does a lot of historical fiction. So this was going to be one of her historical books that take place in the 1970s, which is historical fiction now. Make us feel all very old. But the problem was the whole story is really about people not talking about what's going on, and it's hard to do that when all you have are words. Comics, you can show things happening and no one's speaking about it. And she said when she was writing the story out the first time, she kept having to have the characters run off and talk to each other about what just happened. She's like, that's not at all what happened. Like, what happened was these ridiculous, horrible things happened, and then no one said anything about it. So that's really one of the things that comics enables you to do, just like a movie does. You can show things that are happening and no one's commenting on it, and that silence really is a statement. So this is sort of, as the story unfolds, it's sort of done flashback style. We are actually in Florida, where Sunny has been sent for the summer, the end of the summer, to sort of get away from her family and the drama that's there. And she flashes back to what's going on back home in Pennsylvania. And this is one of the first inklings she has that things are going weird. Her brother takes her out, her older brother takes her out to actually get, to get a gallon of milk. Their mom sends them out for that. But she, while she's there, he meets one of his no-good buddies, and she's glancing out the window and seeing there's a little drug deal going on. And she doesn't know what it is. She knows it's not good. She knows it's secret. And she knows that she's not really supposed to talk about it. There are a lot of moments like that in the book where it's implicit that she's not supposed to talk about it, or her brother specifically says don't. And there's a lot of time with her spent, her eye is, drawn directly to the little bag of drugs in his pocket. And we try to keep it, again, it's a touchy subject. We don't want to show explicit drug use in something that's going to be read by 8 to 14-year-olds. So, we'll keep it vague. It's a bag. We don't know what's in there. We don't show him using drugs necessarily. It's just him acquiring it, and her expression is the reaction. We know this is not a good thing. Now, this is getting into, sort of the flashback moment, and really where we're getting into sort of the central visual moment of showing him using drugs. So this is, she sees a lighter when they're in a drugstore looking for some comics on a spinner rack, and she has this quick flashback of her brother using his lighter in close-up. And it's actually from this longer scene where he's late for dinner, they don't know where he is, so she goes looking for him around the neighborhood. She goes down to this bridge by this creek behind their house, smells some smoke, goes down below and she sees her brother smoking something, we don't know what, presumably pot, but, you know, that's what speaking of touchy subjects, so talking to my mom after, we didn't talk to my mom at all about what this book was about, and she got it, she ordered it from Amazon, and she's like, so, it's like, I don't remember, it's like, he never, you know, your brother never was, like, doing drugs, and we're like, yeah, he kind of was, and she's like, oh, well, just pot. And we're like, well, yeah, okay, in the house that we know of. We don't know what else he was doing. She's like, oh, I thought you meant like heroin or something. Oh, that's fine, okay. So like, okay, that's, you know, I guess, you know, she was growing up in the 60s. That's a different experience, so. But yeah, like, that's the sort of thing, like, that made a big impact on us, like, when he was doing drugs and having all his other behavioral problems that went along with it. You know, they had an impact on the family. And even this thing, which could be innocuous by some standards, you know, he's sneaking off to smoke some pot or whatever, it's indicative of everything else that he's doing in his life and doing to the family. Actually, I'm sorry, go back one. So that was actually one of the visual points of the story that made the longest discussion about with our editor, which was how do we show this? We didn't want to show him like really, you know, smoking, using drugs, and he's certainly gonna have like, you know, a Hollywood 90s style shooting up heroin kind of scene or something. And so we wanted to keep it close on the lighter, close on the glow on his face, and then him quickly hiding because he doesn't want her to see what's going on. You know, and the smoke could be cigarette smoke, could be whatever, but clearly she's alarmed by it, and her reaction is what tells you what's going on. And then this is a separate scene of things that are going on that no one's talking about. Sunny is sent down to Florida to visit her grandfather for the summer, and he is a smoker who says that he's quit smoking, but she keeps seeing and smelling all this evidence that he hasn't quit, and he's hiding cigarettes everywhere. You know, so we've got the ashtray full of cigarettes, which I'm sure many of us remember from our childhood, driving around with either our parents or friends, and you just have the, what now is like, you have the cigarette lighter, which is just to plug in your phone to charge it up, you know? It's like you have an actual cigarette lighter back there. And, yeah, she comes in and she smells smoke in the house. We never show her grandfather ever actually smoking. It's just all this evidence around. And, yeah, he's hiding cigarettes. Pack of Raleigh falls out of the cereal box in her bowl, and he's like, And he's like, it's there for emergencies. You know, you never know. Oh, and one other dangerous thing we wanted to show without even drawing too much attention to it was the fact that in the 70s, we all drove around with no seatbelts, of course, you know. So it's just interesting the stuff that today is so, you know, would just make us cringe and scream. It's like, no seatbelts, that wasn't even a thing. And like, I'm not sure what that child safety seat would do, but that's what they looked like back then. And with smoking, you know, even though it's something everybody did back then, we were still a little concerned about showing people smoking because of what happens, like, with Jeff Smith's Bone, where, you know, one character smokes a cigar, and even though he's not really, like, the nicest character, he's kind of a jerk, you know, then that could be one of the signifiers, like, the fact that he's smoking means that he's not great. We still were nervous about what the immediate reaction was, because there is sort of a knee-jerk, oh, someone's smoking, we can't show that. Just showing it endorses it somehow. And I think you have to try to play with how can you show things that really happen without implicitly endorsing them in the same way.
The thing that I loved about Sunny Side Up was, you know, with addiction, there's always sort of a mental health piece to it. And I think that there's such a very, very few books out there for kids that are about mental health. And I think it's super important because, you know, you see your stories about kids, you know, having anxiety and, you
right.
know, you know, having, you know, dealing with mental health issues, so... So I really appreciate that.
Yeah, and that's one of the, I mean, that was one of the things I wanted to get across, too. It's like, even though it's, on one level, the story of the older brother and his addiction and everything, it's really about what that's doing to everyone else and the anxiety that's causing in Sunny. And the fact that it's not just the drugs, you know, there's also this huge behavioral mental health thing that's going on with her older brother and... Back, especially showing back then, there was no, it was, you know, it wasn't really clear what to do about it. There weren't clear standards about, okay, this kid needs to go to rehab kind of a thing. You know, it's like, maybe go to a child psychologist or like our older brother, you send him off to military school. You know, that's kind of what you did in the 70s. So,
just to add on to this, I've not had a parent contact me by a school about this book.
Yeah.
And when I put it on the shelf, it was fine. I recommended it to a friend's daughter who's in grade 7, and I said, "Oh, I think this will be a really good book that she should be reading." And I get a text from my friend in the role of the mother saying to me, "You didn't tell me all this stuff was happening in the book, all of these issues." She says, "I had to sit down and read it and then have a conversation." I said, "Well, that's
good.
What the book should
do." Yeah.
that's what should happen.
I knew I was going to do something.
So that's one of the things that I really liked about it was that it pushed my friend, because she's been buying graphic novels and comics for her kids for years and never looked at them. She said, "Oh, they're reading that, they're reading that." And then this one was the one that she had to actually sit down with her daughter and actually talk about stuff. And I said, "That's what we want."
Yeah,
so.
Right.
Do you all find that the sort of parental paranoia that their children are being exposed to things that they shouldn't be being exposed to is greater now? Or not as great now?
I think it may be, we may be over the peak a little bit, just in the last like 2-3 years. But I mean, it's definitely with the whole helicopter parenting, highly scheduled kids, never let them out of your sight because disaster could happen. You know, one of my brothers, like we were walking around in Portland where I live, and he saw a parent pulling their kids in a red wagon. And my brother's like, "Oh, those kids should have helmets on." We're like, "What? They're not going down a hill." And it, you know, it's like, we never had helmets when we were kids. You know, we almost died 12 times. But no, not saying that's the best way to do it. It's like, but like, you know, maybe that's a little too far. So, but I think I feel like we're going over the peak of that a little bit in the, like, severe nervousness about what they're being exposed to, I hope. So,
I mean, I had a woman come to me at the library and wanted me to recommend books to her son because she was worried that he was such a really exceptional reader, but she didn't want him to go into YA yet because she was afraid that he was going to be exposed to topics that he wasn't prepared for. And I said to her, "Listen, kids are, you know, the best censors for themselves. You know, if kids are uncomfortable with something that they're reading, they're going to either find it boring or they're going to go, 'This is uncomfortable,' and they're going to put it down." And I think that that's something that I constantly try to stress to parents, that it's okay, that don't worry, that kids will put these things down. I had a young girl, 12 years old, had taken out a book, Moon Boy, by Chris O'Dowd, which has some talk about breasts and, you know, flirting, and she was like, "I don't think this belongs in the, you know, in the juvenile fiction collection." And I was like, "You're 12. You should be reading. You should be like interested in this stuff." But I find that even something like Lane Smith's "It's a Book" that says "Jackass" at the end of the book, I have kids that come up to me and go, "This is not appropriate for this section," and I'm like, "Okay." So I mean, I think that kids are their own censors. Do you find that at your school?
Absolutely. And I was just going to say, I was talking to actually a group of grade 5 students about the fact that I was presenting at this, and I said, "Oh, what about language, and what about this?" And they said, "If I'm uncomfortable reading it, I'm just going to stop reading it." And that was from a 10, 11-year-old. So I found that truly unbelievable, and also the fact that they said, our parents don't care, that's what they said. But I don't believe that that's necessarily true, but I think that you're right in terms of children censoring themselves. They'll know, they'll abandon a book, they'll let it go if they don't feel that it's right for them.
But, I mean, the thing is, though, a lot of parents still don't, I mean, that's right, and a lot of parents aren't comfortable with that anyway. Like the parents don't want their kids reading about war or poverty or sex. Yeah. You know, for reasons that we can be somewhat empathetic about, I guess, but it doesn't help. I mean, the thing I just say to parents all the time is, like, your kids are finding this stuff anyway, so you can choose, you can curate. And also, you can show them good art, or they can find like lousy stuff on the internet. But in truth, the bottom line is, like, you know, there's a lot of parents that don't want. They genuinely think that gender is too complicated for a 10-year-old. What they mean is gender is too complicated for them, because it isn't too complicated for 10-year-olds.
Well, it's funny when I was thinking about this panel and, you know, how we're going to frame it and everything. I was thinking, you know, okay, so touchy subjects, so sex, violence, drug use, racism, poverty, you know, mental health. I'm like, this is just life. Like, this is life. And so important that kids know about life. You know?
Which, you know, I mean, if you're a sex educator, I'm sure you are used to, or you're hoping that they're going to ask you questions after they've seen your book. It was a new experience for me when I was presenting this book to kids, and they had read it, and I was talking about, you know, doing a presentation afterwards, and then they're like, so when they say, you know, Sonny's older brother is going off to get some help, and it's not going to be pretty, what does that mean? You know, I'm like, oh, maybe we talked around the subject too much. But we also wanted to leave it vague because, you know, we wanted to focus the story more on Sonny than on her brother. You know, it's really about her experience and how she's resolving it, not necessarily how he's resolving his problems. But, you know, having to explain to kids what rehab is, you know, and talk to them about what happens with drug use and how that affects people, you know, I guess I was expecting the book to do the work. I wasn't expecting that I was then going to have to, I was the first point of contact for drug education for a lot of these 10, 11, 12-year-olds.
Can I just, I find from the opening presentation today, it was interesting when we were talking about putting location of comics or graphic novels in the section and or integrating them in. Sunny Side Up is right beside Baby Mouse and Squish on my shelves, right? So my girl, and I teach all girls, so I always refer to them as girls. They're seeing your book right beside it. So it's kind of making me start to think, do I move it from that section, or do I, in terms of placing it, right? For the most part, it's my 10, 11-year-olds who are picking up Sunny Side Up. The younger girls tend to be choosing Baby Mouse and Squish still and avoiding Sunny Side Up, but it's still visually attractive.
Right.
So this is kind of something to think about to the audience as well in terms of thinking, I don't know whether or not should I be moving it over to, you know, nonfiction section so that when the students are looking up issues of mental health and, you know, relationships.
I mean, the problem is it becomes sort of a ghetto thing, right, ghetto-wise. The other issue is the thing with the you said nonfiction, right, except, I mean, sure, there's some.
Right,
yeah. But it's also fiction, and
that's
I have the same problem with our book. Like Fiona's work is narrative and creative and beautiful, and our book is always put in a very particular category. Which is, well, this is real stuff. It's not creative, right? When it's not true. So
yeah, that's interesting. You're concerned about being ghettoized by subject matter,
right? Yeah.
Whereas most comics creators are worried about being ghettoized by format.
Exactly.
Instead.
Yeah.
So
I think we're getting to that point where, you know, there's enough children's graphic novels out there within the next, and probably within the next, I would say, 3 to 5 years, is that libraries are really going to have to take a hard look and start to create, like a younger, like almost like a beginning reader, early reader, fiction, like juvenile fiction, like basically three different graphic novel sections. Mm-hmm. One for young readers, one for that sort of like 7 to 10, or sort of six to nine, and then that sort of 8 to 12-year-old. Mm-hmm. I think that's we're just at that point, because it's like you have, like you said, the toon books besides, you know, Sunny Side Up, and it's just, it is, they're for completely different audiences. Where are we at now?
I don't know. Let's see the next picture.
So now we're, I'm going to talk about three books, just sort of like, you know, books that I think of that have touchy subjects, and then Fatma's going to talk about three books, and of course we can all chime in. So Amulet. Amulet, such a huge seller, amazing book, huge circulation, and a lot of people don't realize that at the very beginning of the book, there is a pretty violent death of a parent. So essentially, Emily's father is killed at pretty much within the first 10 pages of the first book. And it's pretty graphic. Like, you basically see the car falling off the cliff. You don't actually see the crash, but then you see the emotional impact of the death of the father on the mother and Emily.
And there's like blame, or at least a sense of personal guilt for it. It's not just like, oh, they died, but like, oh, I was holding on to them and I let go.
Right, exactly. So like I said, I'm just bringing this to the attention of the audience members. And I think it's an important thing, because I think that in a lot of sort of, you know, fiction for that 9 to 12-year-old, it's that whole idea of the child has to sort of grow and learn lessons on their own without their parents. This is why
Potter's parents are killed at the very beginning. You know, in a lot of ways, it's like, get rid of, if you're a parent in a children's book, ooh, we better watch it, because they're probably going to get off. So in this case, it's just the one parent that's killed. But it is a trope that's you know, found in a lot of children's literature, and depicting it in graphic novel form is certainly a challenge. But I think Kazu does a really great job here at it. You know, it has that emotional impact, but it's not gruesome or in any kind of way. And I don't think it's in any way gratuitous at all.
That reminds me, I didn't think about it until after you had put the whole presentation together, but in, now I'm totally blanking on the name of it, in Matt Phelan's book about the Dust Bowl.
Storm
of the Barn. You know, the whole book is almost all black and white or you know, shades of deep gray and everything. But there's a scene where, because of the way that the Dust Bowl, everything died, just about all the plants. But you had these scourges of rabbits that were just, these herds of rabbits would come across the plains looking for food, and people would have to have these rabbit killing drives to stop them from eating what was left of their crops. And so that's the one scene where there's color. And he keeps it off screen, but you know, it's like everything's black and white. You see like the baton going up, and then you see a red panel. So again, getting the impact of that, and so much impact because there's no other color in the rest of the book except for that one spot. So yeah, keeping it off screen, but still keeping the emotional impact there too.
And that seems to be, and that seems to be a technique that's used by a lot of graphic novelists, where it's, especially when it comes to violence, is that it does happen off panel. So I'm not going to use this. Forget it. All right, drama. This is the one book that had such huge controversy. Not so much here in Canada, but in the U.S. I mean, poor Reina. I would always see her upset on Facebook about, you know, the latest review of her book, and I would always say to her, you know what, you're doing an amazing thing. I mean, the book is incredible. She's one of the first comics creators to do an LGBT graphic novel. I still think that we need way more representation in graphic novels for children, and I think, you know, you're starting to see juvenile fiction have a lot more representation of LGBT issues and characters, and I think that's going to start to trickle down to juvenile graphic novels as well. But again, it's a matter of, you know, when you're, you know, prepubescent, you know, and you have, are you gay? Are you, you it's looking at sort of the queer identity without being sexual, but still being, you know, queer.
The thing that's so crazy about the controversy around this, or it just shows you how terrified people are of this, that are out there complaining about it, is that the book it's not even an LGBT book. Yeah. It's just a book about a girl in theater. And guess what? There might be gay people in theater. Or in your school. So upset about is just you're showing that they're gay people that are just there and it's normal, which is just like, that's the thing that's most horrifying.
Just
adding on to that, I can use my big voice too, is that when this came out, I was in a middle school library, so I was working with grade 6, 7s, and 8s, and I was so excited that this book came out because it was just a great, you know, jump off to have the conversation, and no issues whatsoever. And then I'm now in a kindergarten to grade 6 school, and this is like one of the hottest books with the grade 2 students. So you're always amazed that the fact that I was always thinking it was middle school only, but she really has, it is normalized. It's something that is just, this is what life is. So,
and sorry, that book has been on my shelf in my school for a couple of years, and I haven't read it, and none of the kids have come up and said, oh my God, this is about a gay kid.
Yeah.
It's never come up in conversation. No. They just read it as if it's normal.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, like, I went through the book and tried to pick out sort of the major pages where there's, you know, queerness on it. And it's so completely innocuous. I mean, yeah. the first page here is where I forget the boy's name. Josh? Josh confesses to Callie, I think his name's Josh, that he's gay. And then the next page here, you actually see the character having a bit of a crush on one of the characters. But again, it's so, like, school age, innocuous, like, ooh, it's so exciting. but, like, and it's not, like, overtly sexual in any kind of way. And then the third instance that I saw was basically the one character, it's twin boys. And the thing that I really like about this book is, too, is that one of the boys knows he's gay, and the other boy kind of doesn't know what he is. And so there's this sort of, like, gender, or so this sort of, like, sexual fluidity with the one character. And it's apparent, too, when the male character, the other twin boy, has to step in the female role in the play. So essentially, you've got drag on the page here. But again, it's so completely innocuous, and actually quite lovely. So I don't know why people are so up in arms about this book.
And can I just throw in a quick sidebar?
So absolutely.
To bring this book up, I don't want to digress too much, but this is freaking available in French. Can we get some of this other stuff in French too? Mm-hmm. It's like the only graphic novel.
Sunny Sign Up is in French now, I believe.
Yeah,
so,
perfect.
Yes.
Gloucester has a pretty good French division.
Not stuff that deals with this, though.
Yeah.
This is the only one.
Yeah.
And I'm looking for
Well, again, it's, there's just not, there's just, in terms of, in general, there's just not a lot available out there besides this book. Yeah.
And Baby Mouse is in French, too, by the way.
It's secondary school.
You were talking about the, you know, being innocuous and stuff. There's this new picture book called Warm Love Swarm.
Yeah. Oh, I love Warm Love Swarm, yeah.
Somebody asked me, how do you explain this to a five-year-old? I'm like, you don't have to make it too elaborate. You can explain that it doesn't matter what you are. If you love each other, that's all that matters. And you start from that very simple, basic point of, like, it's not about gender. It's not about anything but the love between two people.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's all. Like, I think that's, and you progress from there. And I think it's a great way to start very early, start very young, and see, like, there's nothing wrong with this.
Exactly.
And move on.
All right. We're going to move on. So I want to try and whip through as much of this because I want some time for questions, and we're already almost at 11 o'clock. Child Soldier. So if you haven't read this book, this is an incredibly powerful book published by Kids Can Press. And it's basically the story of Michelle, I'm going to brutalize that last name, Chikwani, who is living in Africa and essentially is living in, where is it?
Is it the Congo?
I think it's Congo, yeah. The Congo, thank you. Where there's lots of sort of political unrest and in this particular situation, because this is a memoir, so this is a true story, the little boy is basically kidnapped by these insurgents and then given drugs and then forced to kill one of his friends. So it's an extremely difficult thing to read, extremely powerful. But I think that Claudia Davila does a really great job at depicting it. I mean, she doesn't really pull any punches in terms of, you know, the fear in the character's eyes, in the depiction of the anger of the insurgents, and the guns are right out there. So let's keep going. So you can see here, this is sort of like a multiple pages, where you see the one of the insurgents is cutting the hand of the young boy to basically rub cocaine into him, so he's, like, you know, hopped up on drugs to be able to essentially, and you see here he blindfolds him, so we have this sort of swirly thing to show that he's sort of disoriented, and then essentially the text says that he basically kills his friend, and you can see you've got the flip-flops, the one with the flip-flops there, and the body is on the ground. So it's an extremely powerful scene, but I think that Claudia did such an amazing job at depicting it in a way that retains its intensity, but it's not overtly graphic in any kind of way. Mm-hmm.
Is that me?
Yeah.
Oh, Chiggers. Okay, so when Scott asked me to be on this panel, it was funny because I had to think of three titles that kind of stood out for me. And Chiggers was one that I had read years ago, but it's always been on my mind. It's always been sitting there. And I always think about the language, and I went back and reread it for this panel, and I was shocked by the language, but
the girls at my school saw me reading because I try to read in front of them so they can see what I'm taking a look at. And they were like, oh, what is that book? Like, they wanted to read it. And this was the grade five group that I was talking to. And I said, you're the audience that would be perfect for this because most of you do actually go away to summer camp. And so I've been holding off. And then what was interesting, because of the use of language in terms of, I love it when I ask them what swear words are. It's usually damn or hell. And then I say, any other words? And they always say, no, those are the bad words. I'm like, oh, well, there's actually other words. And so I tagged the pages and I said, take a look and see what the language is in this. And I always say to them, because she refers to her boyfriend as an asshole at one point, and then they call each other a bitch every once in a while, but it's always in context. And one of my concerns with touchy subjects, especially with parents, is that when they flip open the book, that's the page they come to, and it's completely taken out of context. So that's kind of my other question in terms of how do I make sure that they understand that piece, because I can't talk to every parent all the time. And so I haven't put it in the library, but these girls are encouraging me to. And then it was funny because I flipped it over and it says ages 10 to 14. And I love what you said, Corey, in terms of that's what drives me crazy is putting the numbers on it. But that's what parents look at as well. So if anything, that's somewhat ammunition to say it is actually appropriate for your young daughter to be reading this, and it gives an opportunity, again, to add it to the dialogue. And then one other thing that the girls had said to me when they saw the language was, we know these words. We've seen them before. I guess now it's that they've seen it in print, so I guess I need to just advocate for that piece of the touchy subject and watch my own censorship, because I think that's the other piece that happens as a teacher librarian, is that I love it. One day I was talking to my mother and she said, when did you become so conservative? And I said, I'm not conservative, don't call me that. But at the same time, I'm reading, sometimes it's the touchy subjects that make me stop and forget the whole story. And I've got to remember that it's the story that's most important, not the touchy subject.
And also, if I could just add something, which is that it doesn't work for Bryson Hall, but if you're a public librarian, like when you were, it's a question of who you want to be a librarian for, right? Yeah. So the thing is, like, so there's a really great book, and I can't remember what it's called, and I can't remember the author, mm-hmm. but it's about Potter. It's a kid that's poor, he's homeless, and it's really intense, and it's an early reader, it's for the youngest, and I was reading it, and I was like, this is really depressing, and he's on the street, and he's just living very precariously. But then here's the other thing. Lots of kids his age are in loving that life, and I thought to myself, would I let my kid read this? And then I thought, like, and I thought that the privilege is inherent in that, right? Because like, I don't have a 10-year-old, but I don't want my 10-year-old knowing. Like, I think it's too advanced for my 10-year-old. Except other 10-year-olds are living it.
That's right.
Right. So if you want to be a librarian for poor kids and for kids that are experiencing violence, you need to have some of this stuff. I mean, I know it's more complicated, but yeah, that actually allows me to get through my own stuff about like this. You know, because of course, yeah, there's stuff that you're just like, oh, I wish kids didn't need to necessarily know about that stuff. But most of it is about violence.
Yeah, and I think the other piece is that I also want to have something that's available, and not to be gender specific, but I have to be for girls as well, right? Because I was trying to get the girls to the graphic novel shelf in the library as well, and so this was the book that one of the books that I read by Hope Larson that I was like, this is perfect for my middle school students. But I was also in a community where a lot of them don't go to camp. They live right across the street and they still have a parent drive them to school. And that was in Brampton. So I'm now in a community where I do have students that are, and I'm thinking not to put it on the shelf, but I'm thinking after the conversation with the grade five students and also being on the panel, it's something that I've actually will be putting on the shelf.
Yay.
So, yeah. So, next book, I guess. In real life. This is interesting. How many of you read this one, The Cory Doctorow? I really, really liked it, and I think that one of the overriding messages is so important, but then, of course, there's the language in it, you bitch, you killed my cat, right? And all of a sudden, again, there's that my censorship going, oh, I don't know if I'm going to be able to put this out in the library, because this will be the one thing that the parents, and so, again, you're right in terms of the audience. Who am I thinking about? Am I thinking about the students or am I thinking about the adults? I'm actually sometimes thinking about the teacher as well,
because sometimes it's getting it past the teacher. The girls, and one of the programs in the school is that the girls are looking at money, but I love to talk about the online presence. This is actually one for the library that we have. It's processed and it's in our library. But the other thing, the other piece that I'm also concerned in terms of touchy subjects is, do I start to label them? Because the other labeling is that I could go to a young adult sticker, or I could start to put stars on it and say, you know, if it has, the book has a star, only this student and this student can have it. And so these are some of the struggles that I have when it comes to these touchy subjects with the students. So that was that. That's all I wanted to say about that one. But I think the message obviously overwrote because I put it in the library. Okay, yummy. I was in a middle school library, and I think especially with Black Lives Matter right now and the relevance of the socioeconomic story in this, I had a group of boys at my previous school that had some issues in terms of they weren't reading, so I had to find books that would get them into it, and Yummy was one that was stolen from the library, I think, 2 or 3 times. I replaced it more than any other book in the library. It would just all of a sudden disappear, and I said, I have to buy another copy. But it's shocking to read, and I think the other piece is that we're always adults going in and reading the books before we're giving them to the children. And so there's that whole sense, again, that censorship piece is, I've got to remember to remove that hat or look at it with a different lens and say, who is going to read this and why are they going to read it? One of my concerns about this book, as much as there's hope and there's a lot of question over this young boy who's 10 years old who gets caught up in a gang in Chicago, which, and this is 1994, and you read the newspaper in 2015, and Chicago, this area hasn't changed at all, and it's still a major issue. He's 10 years old, and he's short, and he's cute, and he loves candy. But he has so many issues at home, be it that the mom's in and out of jail for prostitution and drug use and whatnot, and the father's in jail for selling drugs. And so his only community is this gang that he's joined in. And you see depictions of guns in this book. There's not necessarily the language that's an issue, it's just the depiction. And I think it goes really well with Child Soldier in terms of how much violence do we want to put in the children's hands in terms of looking at the images. And again, this is a 10-year-old kid. After he died by his own gang members, like his friends, who were also children, this was inspired by the cover of Time magazine of black-on-black violence in, as I said, 1994. So it's such a good conversation piece, especially in some communities, but it's still a touchy subject because I always think about these books as being the entry point for these conversations.
Cool.
Awesome.
I think we have 8 minutes for questions. Those are all of our Twitter handles, so if you want to
follow us on Twitter.
We talk about lots of different things, graphic novels included. Yes.
Hi. So I was recently working in a neighborhood branch in Malvern area of the city of Toronto, and violence is a big issue there. And these kids do see guns and knives, and they see fights, and it doesn't faze them. If I were to introduce a book like that into the collection, should I be concerned about triggering? I guess it could trigger a conversation, but what if it really upset a child who's, let's say, a sibling had died?
Oh, wow. I don't know necessarily. I guess it could trigger. We never know what triggers are going to, what they're going to be. I will say that, especially with the black youth that were in my neighborhood and in the Brampton area I worked in, they, this was a book they passed around to one another because I think, not necessarily, I think it was the whole relating to the relationships of the friends more so than anything else. And I think they appreciated the fact that it seemed truthful to their lives, even though I questioned, because at one point it's a water gun that he has, like it's not even a real gun that he has, and I know that that's an issue with that as well. The author leaves it very open-ended at the end in terms of who's to blame for what's happening. So I think again, taken out of context, it's so hard. I found it very hard when we were choosing the images to put on this, is that it's all taken out of context. You don't know the before story and the after story for that to be there. I think that the author has to say that because there is going to be a death. We're very clear that there are deaths in the story. So I can't answer that in terms of whether or not it's a trigger point. I do know that it opens up for conversation, and the boy specifically, again, trying not to be gender specific, but in this situation, it brought them into the library, and they were looking for more that were like that.
So where do you send them after?
And that was my issue, right? Because then I could go to Walter Dean Myers and give them Monster, but that's a hard read too, right? And so, and I found it hard as an adult to read it. So that tended to be where you kind of started to gear them to, but again, in terms of representation in books, and especially in graphic novels, it's, you know, the author or the illustrator can only go so far or get so many things out.
Yes?
I find when I have that librarian censorship voice in my head, I look back on things that I read as a kid and go, I wouldn't let a kid read that. Why did they let me read that? Do you find that thinking back, it didn't mess me up, it probably won't mess these kids up. And do you find it's different with what you would allow in a prose book or a graphic novel?
Well, I mean, graphic novels, you have to be aware that you can always immediately look at the whole page without reading anything else. So you can take anything out of context in a split second in the graphic novel. So everyone who's making them is terribly, terribly aware that you have to be very careful about how you're using any images, you know, whether it's violence or a swear word or nudity or something like that, because if it's buried in a page of text, a parent may or may not see that, and it's always the parent that you're worried about, or the teacher. It's always the adult you're worried about, you're not worried about the kid. But with a comic, it's boom, you can take the whole thing in a second. So yeah, that we're always worried about.
I mean, for me as a librarian, I was reading Sandman when I was in like my early teens and things like that, which, you know, has some pretty serious content in it, and it actually made me interested in those topics and to like research them just on my own. I'm a big nerd, so that might be the case, but, I would hope that if kids, especially in, you know, the situation with you, Matt, with the kids saying, well, what happens in rehab, that they would actually go to their library and ask their librarian for books on, you know, drug addiction and things like that, people have to understand that a graphic novel can't give all the answers to every question that every kid has. Especially when it comes to these kinds of subjects, that there is sort of a need for, you know, them themselves to go out and learn more about those topics, or for a parent or a librarian or some other adult in their life who can kind of like talk with them about books. I think, you know, one of the things that I really push in my library with my kids is that, you know, I try my best to engage the kids in discussion about the books. And I say, hey, when you finish reading that, come back and talk to me about it. I want to hear what you think about it. You know, I want to hear about if you loved it, and I want to hear about if you hated it.
Yeah.
You know, I just want kids to have an opinion about books and to be able to have a dialogue about reading. You know, whether or not they get it, you know, got what the content was, I don't care, as long as they're talking about it.
And in terms of the library being, I think just to add on to that, that they're coming back to talk to you, but it's also a safe space, right? The book is a great entry point, and I don't think, you know, Flower, I always laugh about Flowers in the Attic, and I know it's not a graphic novel, but I look back and, you know, we were all, like, I was reading that, and I know my mother read it just so that she knew what I was reading, and she never, ever took it away from me. She was just kind of like, oh, well, like, she's learning something out of that. And so I think It opens up, but it also, I think, makes us connect more, right? In terms of, it doesn't make me feel like I'm sheltered. I'm opened up, and I'm opening. The more I'm reading about these types of things, and books are adding to that dialogue, it's opening the conversation.
And I think books, graphic novels, or prose in general, going into that whole library as a safe space, I think books are a safe space for that too, because it's not like a movie or even a conversation
where you can't stop it. You know, it's something where you can pause and put it down and think about it and come back, and if you get uncomfortable, you know, you can put it back on the shelf. You know, you can close it up and leave it there. Or, you know, it's just this quiet little object. It's not going to actually hurt you.
I remember reading Firestarter when I was 10 and going, oh my god, you can swear in books. And thinking, oh my god, I can't let anyone know that I read it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Hi, yeah, you guys alluded to earlier just the sometimes the differences in the US and in Canada in terms of what do any of you have a book for whom you have an American and a Canadian publisher? And would there be any subtle difference, a cover, you know, a caption box or something like that?
I don't have... We haven't had to do Canadian English translations. We've done UK English translations, which are pretty funny. You know, just because they have, you know, it's not cotton candy, it's candy floss over there, you know. Although we had a foot-long hot dog in the one scene, and they're like, can we make this metric? I'm like, I don't think so. Meter long hot dog, which I hope not, you know. So that was tough. But everything that's coming to Canada for us has either been just the same as US edition or it's been translated into French Canadian. And so I guess there are some differences there, but I don't necessarily know what they are. I don't speak or read French. Though I know for Sunnyside Up, I believe the French translation is Sunburn. As the title, which I thought that was pretty funny.
I just think sometimes that it going the other way, mm-hmm. right, where you start with something that's done by a Canadian publisher and then going to the States, mm-hmm. maybe a higher threshold or
well, I think it's something like this one, Summer, which was published simultaneously by Groundwood Books and Groundwood Books in Canada and First Second Books in the United States, and that book came under. That was one of the books that Fatma and I were actually gonna include, and I was like, oh my god, it's last minute, but we'll mention it. This one, Summer, is written by Mariko Tamaki, illustrated by Jillian Tamaki, and it won a whole bunch of like important library awards, and you know, and it has some kind of controversial content in it, and it's the kind of book that, you know, it kind of the characters are preteen. But a lot of the sort of topics and discussions are teen. So there was a lot of sort of like confusion as to where to put this book. And I think that most libraries are putting it in their teen collection because of that. Because of the, you know, the content in terms of, you know, sex and pregnancy and, you know, puberty and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah. I don't know if that answers your question, but...
I want to thank everybody for doing this panel.